It's early in the morning and all is eerily quiet as the sun streams through the ornate windows of London's Natural History Museum. I'm walking through Hints Hall, looking up at Hope, the 4-ton, 25-metre-long blue whale skeleton, before the doors officially open, with more than 80 million specimens for company, including some collected by Charles Darwin. Established in 1881, the spectacular cathedral-like museum is the backdrop for this week's Convex Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Prospero. I'm heading behind the scenes to meet paleontologist Professor Paul Barrett to find out how reading a ladybird book called Dinosaurs when he was just 6 years old piqued his interest and perhaps in some small way influenced him to become one of the world's leading paleontologists, studying some of the mightiest prehistoric reptiles to walk the earth. Paul is an expert on the evolution and biology of dinosaurs and other extinct reptiles and has published more than 200 papers and books, and I've joined him in the sub-basement. Hello, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And tell me a bit about where exactly we are and what we're surrounded by.
So we're deep in the bowels of the museum here. We're down in the room where we just call the sub-basement, which happens to be the storage area where we keep all of the dinosaur fossils that we don't have out on public display, alongside actually fossil crocodiles as well. So this is where we keep a lot of the fossil reptile material. And we keep it down here because unfortunately it's too heavy to keep on any of the floors upstairs. And rather than have it fall through the floor, we decided it was better to take it to the lowest point of the building.
How extensive is the sub-basement? Because I would imagine you've got an awful lot of things that aren't on display in the main museum.
So we're in a room, I guess, about almost the size of a football pitch, a five-a-side football pitch. And we're surrounded by cabinets. And in those cabinets, we have many thousands of individual dinosaur bones, representing about 220 different species of dinosaur from all over the world.
That's incredible. And are some of those bones that you've had on display, and do you dismantle the dinosaur, if you like, for storage purposes?
That's exactly right. So we do rotate through the kinds of things that we put on display. It doesn't rotate that often, though, because as you can imagine, it's some undertaking to take apart a whole dinosaur skeleton, find some way to store it, and then put a new one in its place. But there are certainly things in this room that have been on display historically that were taken off, either because we wanted to tell a different story or because a new specimen was acquired that looked exciting and fabulous and that we wanted to put out instead. And we do have a slow rotation through those different kinds of objects, basically choosing them on the basis of the kinds of things that we can tell people about with them, whether it's a new type of dinosaur, whether it illustrates something spectacular about dinosaur biology, or if it's simply really visually and aesthetically appealing.
Dippy is no longer here, though. I noticed that this morning, as I walked through, I was under the blue whale skeleton, which is magnificent, but Dippy's not in London anymore.
No, that's right. Dippy's on holiday.
Ah.
And Dippy's been on holiday for quite a while now, actually, doing a tour of the rest of the UK, and has been doing an amazing job for us as a kind of ambassador for the museum in the different spots of the UK that it's been visiting. So right now, Dippy's in Coventry at the Herbert Museum, where it's on an extended loan, and hopefully drawing lots of visitors in from the Midlands to come and say hello. We really like the idea that Dippy goes out because it gives all those people a chance to see it who can't necessarily make it to London. So it's a really nice way of spreading some of the joy of our dinosaur collection in different parts of the country.
Just remind us as well a little bit about Dippy and the history.
So Dippy's actually not a real dinosaur, but a replica, an exact replica of a skeleton from the US, whose original is housed in a museum in Pittsburgh, the Carnegie Museum. But it was the first big mounted dinosaur skeleton of any kind to be put on display in the world, actually, even beating the original in the US by a number of years. So when it first arrived here way back in 1905, when it was very prominently on display, we had all of the great and good lining up for the ceremony at which it was presented. There were headlines all over the world saying, like, welcome, gigantic visitor, and all this kind of thing. So it's very much been part of the museum's public offer for well over 100 years. And although Dippy's no longer in Hintzy Hall, it's now doing a very good job of taking our message to lots of different places around the country.
Which is so important. And you have got one of the finest dinosaur collections in the world, haven't you?
We do. We're very lucky in that respect. At one stage, this was by far the largest single collection of dinosaur objects anywhere in the world. Due to the efforts of my colleagues elsewhere, though, our ranking has slipped a bit. I would guess we're still very much in the top 10, maybe the top 5. But lots of new discoveries coming out of other parts of the world, in particular from the Western US and Canada, from Argentina, and also from China, are starting to build collections that are a bit bigger. But our collection is quite an interesting one in the sense that it's historically very interesting, as we have many of the very first dinosaurs to have been named right in this room, because really the academic discipline of dinosaur studies started in the UK on the basis of material found here in the early part of the 19th century. And so we've built on that heritage by finding new things. We've got things from all over the world as part of our colonial heritage. Things used to get sent back to London from various far-flung places like Southern Africa, Australia, India, places like this that the UK used to have formal closer ties with. And as a result, we have a really diverse collection. So although some of my colleagues in Canada and the US can boast about having more bones, almost all of their bones come from a few places of a particular time period and of a particular type and number of species. Whereas here, our collection is truly global. We have dinosaurs from Antarctica, we have dinosaurs from Europe, we have dinosaurs from South Africa. So we really do have a global sample here, which is somewhat unusual.
And were you in part a tiny bit inspired by the Lady Bird book that I also had as a little girl? Or is that just a great story that occasionally pops up on a press release or article?
I have actually still got that Lady Bird book. It's very tatty now and it's missing its spine and various other bits. But it was genuinely part of what got me interested. I was always an animal mad kid, loved animals of all kinds. Dinosaurs were simply another type of animal, like just a really cool type of animal that we didn't know very much about because they're extinct. And I had lots of other interests growing up as well, largely around the natural world and things like that. But I grew up in suburban London. It's not like I had the luck of living in the countryside and being surrounded by things all the time, which is possibly one of the reasons I like them. It's a bit of escapism. And as a result of all of that, I ended up coming to dinosaurs as really amazing looking animals that actually needed quite a lot of detective work to find out anything about them. So it wasn't just the fact that if I was a modern zoologist, and I make their job sound very easy, though it's not, I could go out and look at these animals. I could sit there with a pair of binoculars, go up to them with a thermometer, work out what their temperature was, watch who they mated with. Not. It's relatively easier to study living animals because you can see them doing things. But with dinosaurs, they've been dead for a long time. A lot of the clues you'd use to think about their biology have rotted away or been distorted by time or are missing because they've been eroded away or never got preserved in the first place. And so you have to get your own kind of deer stalker out and your pipe, and you have to sit there and actually think about, like, this is a cold case from 66 million years ago. How do I take these relatively small number of clues, fill in some evidence from living animals, and come up with the best idea for what this animal was like when it was alive? And that detective aspect of that story really appealed to me.
And how do you do it? 66 million years ago is a long time. As you say, some of the evidence has perhaps been destroyed over those years. What are the key clues that you're looking for when you're perhaps sitting down here in the sub-basement looking at specimens?
It comes from a knowledge of living animals as well. A lot of paleontologists train as zoologists. So we have an idea about anatomy and how muscles attach to bones and how we can find different hints about how an animal might have behaved or lived through using those clues. So for example, we might reconstruct the muscles of the jaws, and that gives us a clue on how the jaws are working. It tells us how hard the animal could bite. It tells us if it can move the jaws from side to side to chew, or if it can move them from front to back. And it gives kind of different clues on what these things might have been doing in the past. So we very much view dinosaurs as living animals. It's just ones, unfortunately, that are dead and that we don't have all of the different bits and pieces from. So we view them through that window very much of thinking about them as living, breathing creatures rather than simply kind of dry, dusty bones.
And do you pinch yourself sometimes when you walk through the main hall and you think that this is what you do for a living? Because it is one of those dreams, almost a little boy's dream, isn't it? Like boys dream of being train drivers or spacemen, or to actually work with something that inspired you as a child and in one of the best places in the world to do it. I would imagine, well, it makes the hairs on the back of my arm stand up. I'd imagine even after 20 years, it's pretty special, is it?
You still get that when you're walking through bits of the museum, particularly at certain times of day when it's a little bit quieter and you get the atmosphere of the building and you come across an object that you've seen a lot of different times, but with slightly different lighting or a slightly different unexpected way. Suddenly you still do get that kind of hair standing up on your arms kind of feeling that you're doing something really special. And we're really privileged here because it's a fabulous building. And I think most of my colleagues would agree that we have access to this amazing resource on the natural world that's almost unsurpassed globally, and that we get to come in every day and we're the people that have the keys and we're the people that can work on that stuff every day. And I have to admit, I still kind of get a real frisson whenever I come into the building, particularly through the central hall, when we see that amazing kind of Richard Owen's cathedral to nature.
It is cathedral-like, isn't it, when the light comes through the stained glass and Darwin's perched elegantly at the top of the stairs. There is that feeling that, yeah, it was named a cathedral, wasn't it, to the natural world.
It was very much done with that in mind. It was to showcase what was going on. So our first director, Sir Richard Owen, who was the person who conceived the idea of the museum and was the political force behind getting it done, was a devout Christian. He saw in the natural world God's doing. And as a result, he wanted to reflect that in the architecture of the building and the way that the objects were displayed within it. So it very much went along with his interests and how he thought that the world was organized. And he managed to make that vision kind of real in bricks and mortar by getting the museum built.
And of course, it's home to so much, isn't it? I mentioned in the introduction, 80 million specimens, some of those collected by Darwin himself. But the dinosaurs are a huge part of the museum, but it pays homage to the whole natural world, doesn't it?
It does. It's not just dinosaurs. So although many of our visitors come primarily to see the dinosaurs, there's all sorts of other things to look at as well. So all other aspects of the animal and plant kingdoms are represented somewhere in the galleries, and even in the architecture of the building. If you look up and you see these amazing terracotta sculptures that line the older parts of the building, they were selected specifically to tell that story of life and how it's all interconnected. And things like at one end of the building, you'll see most of those little gargoyles are extinct things. At the other end of the building, you'll see they're mainly living things. And that goes back to the original plan of the museum, that at one end of it, you'd have all of dead things. And at the other end, all of the more recently dead things, kind of living things. And that was part of the map of the museum, of how Owen imagined that people would use it, almost like a catalogue.
I think what's extraordinary is that catalogue continues and is very relevant today. And when we're all putting our minds to climate change and dealing with the biodiversity loss, you know, I walk through the museum today and see you're making gardens that are looking at biodiversity loss. So although you step in time often millions of years, there are also people dealing with some very current issues here too, which keeps the museum really relevant and cutting edge.
It does. So we work on all sorts of things here. My colleagues range on everything from the early evolution of the solar system, because I have colleagues that work on meteorites and use those to reconstruct the very first stages of the formation of the Earth and of the planets, all the way through to people who are working on current issues right now to do with things like plastic pollution or how we get new elements that we'll need for the smart technologies of the future. So we do a huge range of things here, as well as cataloguing the diversity around us. And we're working very hard at that too, because obviously we need to do that to make sure we know what we've got before we accidentally lose it.
Has the digital age and AI helped, Paul, in terms of your work and the research you're able to do?
So these are things that are starting to take off in a big way, partly to capture what we have got, to preserve it forever, and also to make it easier to share with colleagues around the world. One of those aspects is if we are going to work in a truly global network, it's much easier to share digital images or digital models of specimens than it is to expect people to come and visit them to see them face to face. So there's a huge push at the moment to try and make much more of that data available online so that not only colleagues but members of the public will be able to access it more easily from wherever they are in the world at the touch of a button. But it also means that we're using those digital kind of avatars of specimens, if you like, in new and exciting ways. So we can use, for example, 3D models of some of the specimens we use to perform really interesting, say, engineering analyses of specimens that are non-destructive. We don't need to cut them up. We don't need to subject them to all sorts of weird pressure tests. We can just make a model of it, put it in a computer, and let the computer do those kinds of tests to it without damaging it. So there's a huge amount of work being done on those kinds of digital assets, not only in sharing information, but in terms of generating new knowledge too.
Yeah, I was thinking that sort of AI and digital probably help you with finding clues and things like that. And I would imagine in the two decades you've been here, techniques and research tools have probably changed quite considerably.
Oh, they have. So it's now about 30 years since I did my PhD. And when I was doing my PhD, you'd go to a scientific conference and you'd hear the usual talks and hear what people are doing. And then at that time, people had just started experimenting with CT scanning. So familiar to many of us if we've ever had to go in for a scan at a hospital or a dentist or something. And they were just starting to adopt that technique also to look at fossils so that we could peer inside the fossils without having to break them or break them open and to image them in new and exciting ways. And in the mid-1990s, while I was doing my PhD, if someone showed one of those CT scans at conference, the audience would literally gasp, like with amazement. It was almost like people invented fire for the first time. And you would just hear a sharp intake of breath as the model would come up and maybe spin around in three dimensions. And you would just see people gobsmacked, mouths open, watching. I go to a conference now, sit through the same kind of presentation. Everyone starts looking at their watches going, oh, not another CT model. We've seen 300 of those already today. This is kind of a standard thing. What's the new thing? What's the new next thing to come? So it's really revolutionized the sorts of things we can do. And we are constantly finding new techniques, often borrowed from engineering or from medicine, that allow us to look at those fossils in new and kind of innovative ways and to really get more and more out of them. So one of the reasons for keeping them all is simply that we can keep going back to those specimens when these new techniques become available and extract even more information than we were allowed to by the previous set of tools that we were using.
It's really, really exciting. I mean, you're discovering new specimens, new dinosaurs, but this is much more, feels much more to me, Paul, than just looking back millions of years in time. Are we learning about evolution and learning things that are really relevant about life and biological life today by going back to prehistoric times?
So there are lots of examples we can take from work on extinct animals that actually inform what's going on today. So for example, the past gives us a series of natural experiments in what happens with climate change. So at the moment, we're obviously going through a period of climate change that's been largely caused by human industrial activity. But we've also had natural swings in climate caused by changes in the Earth system in deep history. So we can go back to those and see what animals and plants did during those periods of, say, increased global warmth. Did the animals die out? Did they move away? Did they change somehow? So we can use those past experiments in natural global warming to give us a few indications on what might happen in today's warming world if it continues to warm at the pace it does. So we can use the fossil record, almost like a library of these natural experiments in how animals and plants react to those kinds of changes. And they can help form new baselines, if you like, for what we might expect to happen in future, given current state of environmental change.
And what are those findings have you found most interesting and perhaps most useful right now as we face the climate crisis?
So dinosaurs themselves don't have too many things to say about what's happening now. They did live through a lot of climate change, but they're not particularly good models for understanding what might happen to today's reptiles. They differed in too many ways, really, to be useful. But one project it did do actually was on turtles. So I had a little sideline working on turtle evolution. And what we did in that case was looked at some of these intervals in the Earth's past when it was hotter than today, cooler than today, and we added up the number of turtle species that were on Earth at any one time, and then looked to see if that number was affected by these global climate indicators. And what we found was actually turtles were controlled, their distribution around the world and number of types of turtles were controlled by some aspects of global climate, in particular how wet it was and how cold it was at the coldest time of year. And when we looked at how that changed through time, we could actually see in some of these intervals, the turtles would expand out to occupy and live in different areas where they don't live now. Other times, their range would come back and contract down again. And so that allowed us to see how turtles would respond if there are no humans around and if they have time to respond to that change on an evolutionary kind of timescale. So for example, in the case of turtles, it turns out that if our current warming scenarios are correct, a number of turtles in places like the Congo Basin, the Amazon Basin, places that today are very wet and very conducive to having lots of turtles in them, are actually going to dry out a bit. And the turtles are going to have to start leaving those areas because the habitat that they would normally live in will shrink. But although those areas are getting drier and hotter, other parts of the world are actually getting warmer from where the cooler areas they are now and wetter, which means that in an ideal world, the turtles would be able to evolve to actually move to these other new areas that are now more suitable for them. So if you didn't have anything in the way of turtles, and they don't move very fast, let's face it, they would be able to spread out and colonize these new areas. So although they might become extinct in one area, there might be a ray of hope in that they might be able to colonize new areas. The big problem, though, for turtles is time. So these events that we're talking about in the deep past happened over tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. But we're looking at very rapid change in time that might be taking hundreds or thousands of years. So a lot, lot faster. So they might simply not have time to, although there might be new areas for them to go to, they might not have time to naturally reach those areas. But from a conservation perspective, it means that, for example, you might be able to say, you know what, these turtles that are dying out in this particular region now, if we transplant them somewhere else, maybe they'll do okay. So there are still things that we can talk about in terms of modern conservation problems, even from a very deep time historical perspective, that might be practically useful.
That's fascinating. And do you like having a little sideline in turtles sometimes? Is it refreshing to just take a little bit of a break sometimes from the bones and fossils that you're dealing with on a daily basis?
It is. So I have very broad interests across like the reptile part of the tree of life. And although my primary specialization is dinosaurs, it is sometimes nice to work on something that is, for a start, a lot easier to move around. The average dinosaur bone is pretty heavy, whereas turtles are generally quite small. So moving turtle fossils around or finding information on those is sometimes a nice antidote to working on like a 200 or 300 kilogram bone where you need three colleagues to help you turn it over to look at the other side.
What is it though, Paul, that excites you the most? What discoveries have you made over the last number of years that have really lit you up and thought, wow, that's incredible. This is why I do this.
Well, I think one of the things that really gets to you to start is finding a new fossil. So it's not even doing the research on it. It's actually just finding it in the first place. Because it doesn't matter where you are. You could be on the Jurassic Coast in Dorset. You could be in the middle of the bush in South Africa. You could be in the Badlands in the US. You are really likely to have been the first human ever to see that object. So you're the first person to actually see that thing that may have been in the ground for tens or hundreds of millions of years by the time you see it. And it's a moment of pure discovery that I don't think you get in many other ways, because it's an object that's been revealed by erosion for the first time, and you're the first set of human eyes ever to see it. So there is that aspect of genuinely being that first wow moment of seeing something. I think you probably do get in some other areas of science. I can imagine that astronomers get this moment when they see a new thing in the sky. But in general, it's something that's an intimate personal moment that is yours and doesn't belong to anybody else for that few seconds that you're the first one.
And does your work involve going to places like you just described and going on digs and seeing things being revealed for the first time?
It does. So I'm lucky enough to do some field work. I don't do lots and lots, but I usually have a couple of field trips per year. And most of my work over the last 10 years or so has been concentrated primarily in Southern Africa, in South Africa and Zimbabwe, working with colleagues down there and digging up material of some of the earliest dinosaurs. So from dinosaurs about 220 million years ago, which are some of the first well-known dinosaurs to have walked the planet, basically. And we're doing that in order to fill in some of the early history of dinosaurs, which is a bit more mysterious than the later ones, things like Tyrannosaurus that are very well known. Instead, this is going right back to the roots of the dinosaur family tree and trying to untangle some of the various branches down there.
I think you're just back from South Africa. Give us a bit more of an idea of those early dinosaurs and how you know that you're going to look at things that are that old.
So we go there because we know we have rocks of the right age and the right type. So rocks of the right type are ones that are laid down by rivers and lakes or deserts, things that form on the land surface and that are made of sediments. So sands, mudstones, limestones, things like that. Those are the types of rocks that preserve fossils, whereas volcanic rocks, for obvious reasons, melt fossils or burn them or destroy them. So we're looking for rocks that were laid down that are made of sediment. Then we're looking for rocks of the right age. And for early dinosaurs, we're looking for rocks of Triassic age, and these are rocks that would be dated between about 235 and about 200 million years old. And we know from work that's already been done on these rocks that they're that age, and we get to those ages by using a variety of radioactive elements as a kind of internal clock for those rocks, and also just by looking at their relationships with other rocks in the region, whether they're on top of some, whether they're underneath some. You can actually read the layers of rock a little bit like a book. So we know we're looking at the right type of rock in the right place. And then it comes down to the sheer luck, actually, of finding a dinosaur. There's no real formula for finding a dinosaur. You just go and look at the ground and hope that you see a lump of rock or a bit of thing sticking out that's slightly different from the rest of the rock around it. And then hope that that turns into a bone. And then as you dig around, you hope that that bone turns into lots of connected bones. So it's not a particularly technical process. There aren't any tools that we use. We don't use things like radioactivity. We don't use ground penetrating radar. None of those things seem to work. People have tried them. It doesn't work. The only thing that really works is just walking and staring at the ground a lot and hoping for one of those things, or just a little bit of luck that one of those bones is sticking out for you to find.
Tell us about a moment where a little bit of bones sticking out and then you uncover more bones and part of a significant skeleton. What's been the most exciting moment for you on that front?
So I'm going to be totally honest, I suck at finding dinosaurs in the field. But I go and I spend a lot of time looking at the floor and finding bits and pieces. The key thing is to work with people who are really good at doing it. So a number of my colleagues are much better at spotting these things in the ground. So my skill tends to come in that I have fairly high boredom threshold, and I'm very good at then sitting in a hole with that bone and exposing it. So it comes down to some people like walking a lot and staring at the ground and spotting something, but then don't have the patience to actually dig it up. Whereas I can walk around for ages and not find anything, but I do have the patience to sit down and excavate something. So I don't find that many things when I'm out there. I find bits and pieces. But probably my most significant thing was a fossil I found on a trip to Zimbabwe a couple of years ago. We were walking along the shores of a huge man-made lake in Zimbabwe called Lake Kariba, which forms the boundary between Zimbabwe and Zambia. And this is an area that's essentially new ground for paleontologists. It's not been seriously explored at any point. And I was there with a mixed team of colleagues from South Africa and Zimbabwe and elsewhere. And we were just walking along the shore of the lake looking for exposed rock where we might find dinosaur fossils. And very unusually, I was the first person to spot something on this particular beach. And it turned out that as we had a look around it, it was a part of a dinosaur. And it's actually the leg of a dinosaur. And the leg was there kind of in what we call articulation, in a kind of natural pose with the thigh bone still connected with the shin bone and the other bones below it. And so this became affectionately known as Paul's leg. It can be named things like that because I don't find that many things, so people remember who finds them. And in this particular case, we excavated that dinosaur. It went back to a lab in Johannesburg. Ultimately, it will go to a museum in Zimbabwe. And that is actually a new species of dinosaur. So this is the first time that I've actually found something that is going to become a new dinosaur myself, as opposed to doing it because someone else has already spotted it and pointed it out to me, or because I've discovered it in a museum drawer. So although I've helped dig up a lot of dinosaurs, I'd be very honest at this point, I absolutely suck at spotting them in the field. I'm very good at falling over in the field. That's my major skill.
I think sitting in a hole and actually being patient is also a skill. So I think that's fine. Reading an article you wrote recently, I think you talked about this being a very special age for dinosaurs at the moment. There's a bit of a renaissance going on. Why is that? And is that through discovering new specimens?
It's for lots of reasons, actually. It's partly that there are more people around the world looking now. And in particular, there are more people in places that formerly didn't have dinosaur experts. So as a result, there are just more expert eyes looking for those new fossils and interpreting them better. In the old days, most of work on dinosaurs was done by people in Western Europe and North America. They would send expeditions out around the world, bring things back to the big museums in Europe or the big museums in the US and do that work. But now there is a lot of local expertise. People are trained, they go out, they have world-leading labs of their own. And so they are now going out looking for things, which means the pace of discovery has increased. And while the pace of discovery has also increased, our ways of looking at the fossils have also got more sophisticated. As we already talked about, we have these kinds of new techniques now like CT scanning, where we can reconstruct fossils with a higher degree of detail than we ever could before. So the combination of more things, more people, more technology is actually really accelerating the pace of those discoveries. And at the moment, it's something like one dinosaur a week gets described, a new dinosaur from somewhere in the world on average. There's one a week. It used to be really easy to keep up with new dinosaur discoveries. When I was a student 30 years ago, I would go to the library on a daily basis to prevaricate, usually to avoid doing something else, and look for a new journal article on dinosaurs to see if there was something. Most days I would go away empty-handed. These days you get several articles per day, every day of the year, describing something new to do with dinosaurs. So the amount of work that's being done has increased by more than an order of magnitude. So there's a huge amount of work going on, and it's got to a point where it's very difficult to keep up with all of that work. So we often become more and more specialized on even particular groups of dinosaurs or particular questions to do with dinosaur biology rather than knowing everything about all of them.
So this is giving us a much better picture of what was going on all those millions of years ago. And I suppose I'm fascinated with dinosaurs. Paul, just indulge me with a few facts and the basics of what we know about that time and what our Earth looked like when these magnificent giant reptiles were walking and flying.
So extinct dinosaurs were around for 160 odd million years. So it's a vast amount of time. So when the first dinosaurs appeared, the world looks very different from now. All of the continents are joined together into one single supercontinent. There's no Atlantic Ocean. There's no Indian Ocean. Just one large blob of land surrounded by one huge ocean. And dinosaurs evolved in that world. And it was a lot warmer on average than it is today. So very, very different. Even the plants that the animals were living inside were very different as well. So they would have lived in a world that was dominated by things like conifer trees, which we're still familiar with today, cycads, ferns. There were no grasses, no flowering plants at this time. A very green world in places, but not a particularly colourful one as far as the plant kingdom is concerned. And then all through the time that dinosaurs are around, that supercontinent breaks up due to geological forces. We get the formation first of the Atlantic Ocean. They continue to split up. We get the beginnings of the Indian Ocean. The continents continue to split apart until by the time the last dinosaurs are on Earth, about 66 million years ago, they start to look a little bit like the continents we're familiar with today. They're starting to get towards the right places, but there are still some big differences. India, for example, is a giant island in the middle of the Indian Ocean, hasn't yet collided with Asia. Parts of North America are flooded by a shallow sea, essentially split into two islands, one on the west and one on the east. So it's still quite different, but a lot more similar today, still warmer. The world by that point is a lot lusher. When dinosaurs first appeared 240 odd million years ago, the Earth's quite arid. By the time that they could become extinct, it's actually a lot more seasonal, a lot cooler, so there are a lot more forests, things like that. So even dinosaurs live through a world that's changing the entire time. And they were evolving against that backdrop of geological change and changing the plants and changing the other animals that lived alongside them.
If any of my school teachers are listening, I really apologise for this question, but what was it that wiped them out 66 million years ago? And I know, Paul, that that's shameful that I'm even asking that, so I'm slightly embarrassed.
Well, over the years, there have been a lot of different ideas, and some of them we would now regard as completely bonkers. So, for example, it was suggested that they were wiped out by aliens. It's been suggested that they were all wiped out by a disease. There was also this old idea called racial senescence, whereby they actually just got too big for their own good and then they kind of just got bored and died. There are over 100 theories have actually been proposed to account for dinosaur extinction. But the one that most people subscribe to today, which has a lot of evidence for it, is that they were victims of a chance event. And that chance event was a giant asteroid coming from outer space, hitting the Earth, and basically creating chaos that led to the extinction, not only of dinosaurs, but also of a lot of the other animals and plants that lived alongside them.
What I love about really bright, clever scientists like you, that I can ask what feels like not a great question and you don't make me feel silly for asking it. I'm glad there are lots of theories.
They're questions that are worth asking.
Yeah.
And no one always knows the answer. I mean, we're still seeking those answers all the time. So scientists are constantly asking questions and constantly trying to prove ourselves wrong.
Almost 30 years ago, you made your first trip to China, one that I think, Paul, has developed into a fantastic relationship with Chinese scientists and Xu Xing in particular. China is one of the best places, isn't it, for dinosaur fossils? Tell us a bit about China and the kind of work that's going on there.
Chinese dinosaurs have exploded onto the scene really in the last 30 or so years. So dinosaurs have been known from China since the 1920s, 1930s, although actually many of the, in quotes, dragon's bones that you often would find in Chinese kind of traditional medicine shops were often fossil bones, some of which may well have been dinosaurs. But the scientific study of dinosaurs in China started in the 1920s, picked up through the 1940s with some interruptions due to World War II, but was being done, but in a relatively small way by just a handful of specialists. But what really kickstarted the Renaissance in Chinese paleontology was the discovery of dinosaurs with feathers. So these amazing specimens from about 125 million years ago from an ancient lake deposit that had these beautiful, complete little dinosaur skeletons, not only with all of the bones intact, but also with impressions of feathers and other skin structures all around them. And this was the culmination of an idea that had been around for a while, that birds and dinosaurs are intimately related with each other and that birds are part of the dinosaur family tree. And that idea had been growing in popularity, but there were still a number of people who didn't accept it, didn't think there was good enough evidence. But these feathered dinosaurs, if you like, were that final straw that broke the camel's back. And finally, it was kind of, yes, I mean, feathers are such a complex, odd structure. They can't have appeared more than once, surely. And so these animals with feathers, these dinosaurs, they must be close to the ancestry of birds. So suddenly, there was a huge rush of work on Chinese dinosaurs, partly around these new dino bird type fossils, but also partly just because there was a new generation of Chinese scientists that were being trained at that time who were going out doing field expeditions of their own and having a lot of luck in finding some spectacular dinosaur graveyards. And China's a huge country, and parts of it are very desert-like and have exposed rocks of the right age and the right type in huge amounts. And by going to these places, suddenly tons of fossils started coming back to the labs in various cities in China. really deluging them with a wide variety of new species, and it's probably the region with the highest number of new species that were discovered over the last 30 years.
And have you enjoyed those trips over to China and working with experts over there?
It's been a genuine privilege, actually, because you get access to this amazing new material. And my collaboration with Xu in particular, Xu Xing, we've been friends for a very long time. We first met on my first trip out there in 1995, when I was a fairly green PhD student and he was still doing his master's degree. He was told, and I don't think he was very happy about this at the time, that he had to accompany me and my other British colleague, Paul Upchurch, on this trip because we needed a Chinese-speaking person to accompany us into some of the more remote areas of China we visited to go to various museums. And Xu was sent with us as our interpreter. So we spent a lot of time on very long train journeys, passing the time with each other. It was a 36-hour train journey in those days from Beijing to Chengdu, whereas it's about a two-hour flight now. So we had a lot of time to get to know each other. And as a result, we developed a very good, deep friendship, which also became a working relationship. So we worked on new dinosaurs together, and we have lots and lots of things in common where we've gone out and done that kind of work. I've never done field work with him, unfortunately, but we have done lots of other work together.
Maybe that chance will present itself at some point. When you talk about dinosaurs with feathers, I always think of the heron. I think the heron is probably my favourite species in the world of birds. And you can't help but feel there's some prehistoric feel to watching a heron fly across a still lake. Would a heron come down from feathered dinosaurs? I'm just thinking of its shape.
So all birds are descended from dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So when we think about the dinosaurs that were the closest relatives of birds were small little live meat eaters, so a little bit like Velociraptor. So Velociraptor, famous from Jurassic Park movies, is a very bird-like, not yet bird dinosaur. Although in the movies they don't have feathers, we know from other fossils that they would have had feathers. So they would have already had plumage. They probably had some bird-like intelligence as well. We know they have fairly big brains and things like that. And when you look at the details of their anatomy, when you strip the skin off and you think about just the bones, they are very, very similar to a bird skeleton underneath. So all birds, as far as we can tell, are descended from some kind of small meat-eating dinosaur, which technically makes them part of the dinosaur group. They're the only living dinosaurs. It just so happens that the only living ones that we've got today have feathers and fly, whereas all of the extinct dinosaurs that we think of tend to have been bigger and a lot of them were scaly. When we tend to think about the evolution of groups of animals, we tend to think of them a little bit like those Russian dolls, you know, the kind of babushka dolls, where you have a little tiny one inside a bigger one inside a bigger one. So if you like, birds are the smallest little doll in a big nest of other reptiles and dinosaurs, and they are just descended from one particular group of dinosaurs. And for reasons we don't fully understand, they're the only group that made it past that cataclysm that killed out off all the rest of the dinosaurs 66 million years.
That's extraordinary. And you have a dinosaur named after you, Paul, which I would imagine is a massive honour. Tell me about your dinosaur.
I do. It actually probably marks a point. I'm just getting to a point in my career where I'm getting old. been old enough to merit having something named after me. It's very kind of my colleagues to do that. So it's particularly nice actually for me for two reasons. One reason is it's a British dinosaur. And although British dinosaurs do come along, they don't come along as often as they do from other parts of the world. So it's kind of feels special that it's from my home country as well. But also it's from a group of dinosaurs I have worked on as well. So it's nice to see a new member being added to that family. And I think I said at the time, it's also pretty appropriate. These things are kind of slow moving and spiky, and that's probably fair enough in terms of being an accurate description of me as well.
And so, armoured, isn't your dinosaur armoured too?
It is, yeah. So it's basically a very low slung, slow moving, four-legged dinosaur, a little bit like an armoured tank moving along. So these things covered in bony spines and plates for defence. Vegetarians, these ones.
And a wonderful name as well. I'll let you say the name. I could pronounce it, but it'd be nice to hear you say it.
So it's called Vectipelter barrettai.
Ah.
So it means, Vectipelter means armoured thing from the Isle of Wight. Vectis being the old name for the Isle of Wight, where it's from, and then barrettai for obvious reasons.
Gosh, that's wonderful, isn't it? You've been in the Department of Earth Sciences for 20 odd years now. How is the collection viewed globally, do you think? I mean, obviously, we're very proud of what we've got here in Britain. But in China and in other countries where they're doing a lot of dinosaur work, are people still in awe, really, of what we've got here at London's Natural History Museum?
Oh, we've still got a huge number of international visitors. And that's primarily for the reason that we hold a lot of historical specimens here. So people come to look at the originals of some of the things that were described way back in the 19th century. Also because we hold a number of what are called type specimens. So type specimens are, if you like, the index specimen for a particular species. So whenever a new species is named, you have to say this particular fossil or this particular beetle or this particular plant is the example which has the features that make it a new species, and it's the reference for that species. So we have a lot of what we call the type specimens for different dinosaur species here in this room. And as a result, it's a library for anybody working on dinosaurs to come and see if the animal that they've just dug up is something new or whether it actually should be called, given the name that already is existing for something in a collection either here or in one of the other big museums around the world.
Just as we draw to a close, you went to Cambridge and graduated with your bachelor's in zoology. I think you also went to Oxford as well. Did you ever consider any other career at that point? I know you said originally you were studying zoology. Had you ever thought about anything like a, I don't know, perhaps a vet or anything like that?
Actually, when I was a kid, I did consider being a vet, because a lot of my interest comes into thinking about these things as living animals. And I still have a strong interest in living animals as well as mainly working on extinct ones. But what really put me off of being a vet was James Herriot. So I read James Herriot at a relatively formative age. I read them all avidly, thought they were terrific books. And I thought that any career that involved getting up at 3 a.m. to stick your arm deep inside the backside of a cow was not something that I wanted to do.
Do you know, I could play the James Herriot theme tune on the piano when I was a little girl, and those books made me want to be a vet, but I wasn't bright enough, so I got up at 3 a.m. and went on breakfast television instead. Much better than being a vet. What are you looking forward to most? What's happening in your dinosaur museum world that's coming up that feels exciting at the minute, Paul?
Well, at the moment, we're working collaboratively with lots of different people around the world. So I have another colleague here, Susie Maidman, who's the museum's other dinosaur specialist, and we do a lot of work together. Susie has her own projects and is doing her own thing. So she is doing some really exciting work in North Africa at the moment, while I'm working at right the other end of the continent in Southern Africa. So between the two of us, we're finding a lot of new things coming out of those two different digs. And we're working on a lot of new species that we've found over the last couple of years that we're going through the formal descriptions of at the moment in order to get those new names out for people to use. So watch this space, because we're hoping to have 3 or 4 new dinosaurs coming out in the next year or two.
Really? That's fantastic. Are you allowed to give any clues as to when those dinosaurs may have walked the planet or what kind of dinosaurs they are?
Sure, so I can give you a couple of hints.
Go on,
so
a couple of hints.
One of the animals we're working on at the moment actually comes from Antarctica. So it was discovered by an expedition in the 1980s, but for various reasons has just never been worked on up until now. So we're trying to bring that animal back to life at the moment and get it named and get it out for people to know more about and to integrate it more tightly into our general picture of how dinosaurs evolved overall.
There's never a dull moment, I would imagine, working here. I know that, you know, my final question of every podcast in this season has been about risk. So I'm just curious to know, Paul, what's the biggest risk you've ever taken? And it can be from childhood or adulthood or your career. What is the biggest risk, do you think?
I'm a relatively risk-averse person, so it's actually quite a difficult question to answer. I think it probably comes down to some of the big decisions we've made over the specimens here. So in particular, my proudest moment at a museum in a lot of ways is acquiring our Stegosaurus specimen, Sophie, which is on public display out in the galleries. And that was a major investment in museum time and resources and effort. And it was a secret project for a while. And in terms of trying to get the museum to buy into that project and then hoping that I hadn't sold them a dud, I think was probably one of the biggest risks. That was a big financial risk and also a big kind of reputational risk if it all went wrong.
Well, you've whet my appetite now, because I'm glad I did ask that question. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had your best story out there. What was the backstory to Sophie, who I stood with for a few minutes, actually, before I came down into the sub-basement with you?
So we found out about Sophie by accident. I happened to be at a fossil fair in the US. There are these big commercial fossil fairs where they hawk various things, mainly to a gem trade and things like that. But museum professionals sometimes go as well. And while we were walking around, there was a replica of this amazing Stegosaurus skeleton. And my colleague I was with, Martin Munt, and I went up to speak to the person looking after it and said, "Oh, that's really cool. It's nice. What is it?" And he explained, "Oh, yeah, this is a replica of one that's for sale." it's currently available. Are you interested? And we looked at each other and thought, yes, we are interested, definitely. We didn't have any Stegosaurus specimens in the museum, and this was a complete mounted skeleton, would look beautiful in a display. So we thought, yes, we'll try. So we came back and we put in a pitch to our various bosses, and it trickled up the chain of command here at the museum until it ended up with the director. Just by sheer luck, it happened to coincide with a new major donor approaching the museum without an agenda, just saying they wanted to do something nice for the museum. And we were able to bring that money that that donor brought to the project and get the specimen and also to install it as a public display. So it was a very quick process in the end, and we almost lost it because it turned out there was a second bidder, and it came down to a last minute phone call from our director to assure the owner that we wanted it and the money was on the way to secure it. There was another bid for it. So we were quite lucky to get it. And then we decided to keep it secret for a year to allow my colleague Susie and I to actually do the scientific work on the specimen before we put it out on public display. Because once it's on public display, it's much harder for us to access because we can only do it when the public aren't in, so that we're not in their way and all that kind of thing. So we spent a year in secret doing this work behind the scenes and trying not to drop too many hints that we had this amazing new thing. I actually at one point had a lot of stuff on one of those little data sticks that I thought I lost in the public gallery. And I had about 24-hour period of like thinking, oh my God, I've just blown this thing we've kept secret for 6 months. And turning out that then this data stick was actually in my bag like the entire time that I'd looked through. But I was convinced I was going to get fired for like letting the cat out of the bag too early by someone finding this thing. And then actually putting it together and getting it out on display, we did a number of practice mounts behind the scenes so that we knew exactly how it went together and that we could do it efficiently. So in the end, I think we got it out there and we got it put up in about 2 hours.
Well, Sophie, the Stegosaurus is really amazing. And I think the great thing is that you spend time with her and you realise that she's not a replica. I think that's tiny, maybe bits or a little bit replica, but essentially it is Sophie the Stegosaurus, isn't it?
You're looking at a real thing. So there are a few things that are replica because they were missing in the original. So one or two small bits. And actually the skull is a replica. We do have the original skull. It's actually where we're sitting now in this room, but it's too delicate to put out on public display. So there's a replica of the skull on the skeleton, but the rest of the skeleton is the real thing.
Wow. Well, I feel really lucky that my children have grown up coming to the Natural History Museum. And I feel very lucky that you've allowed me behind the scenes in the sub-basement surrounded by dinosaurs in the cupboards. I'm dying to have a peek, actually. And it was really humbling standing in the Hints Hall by myself before you opened to the public. So thank you, Paul, and keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, great pleasure. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Professor Paul Barrett, one of the world's leading paleontologists from London's Natural History Museum, talking dinosaurs, prehistoric times, and why this is a golden time to be studying paleontology. Download our podcast at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple and Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to yours. I'll be back next week, so join me then.